Welcome, everybody. This is Lecture 2 of the Mises Academy online class, Anarcho-Capitalism. Today is August 8th, 2012, and the topic of tonight's lecture is what I'm just calling Private Law 2. Just a clarification, last week during Lecture 1, I had erroneously described the distinction. I was going to say, oh, in Week 1, we'll give the basic framework of how private law would work, and then in Week 2, we'll deal with objections, but then I realized afterward we've already allocated, I think it's week four, to handling objections. So week three is going to handle private defense, and then week four is going to be sort of a catch-all for the kind of objections people would raise to the private law, private defense framework we've built up by the third week. So tonight, instead of dealing with objections, because that would just be anticipating what I was already going to handle in week four, instead I just thought we'd probe deeper into private law, because there's plenty of material, things that I couldn't talk about last week that is very important to get under your belt, so I might as well just go over some of those things. Just one or two housekeeping announcements. Danny wanted me to let you guys know that he fixed, there had been some broken links. So there's excerpts from For a New Liberty, I think I'm dealing with the court system, something like that, that I believe would have been under week one's readings. Apparently that link was broken and now it's fixed. The other thing is I had them add something, so if you haven't looked at the syllabus in a while, there's something new there if you're interested. And this is purely optional, but I think this was like a year or two ago, I wrote a paper talking about, suppose for the sake of argument, that the threat from man-made climate change is real, right? So normally libertarians and Austrian economists who don't want the government to tax carbon or who don't want a cap and trade scheme, a lot of what their objection has been to attack the science and to say, hey, there's uncertainty, these computer models are crazy, are you kidding me? Do you think that the little amount of CO2 we emit in the grand scheme of things is going to cause glaciers to melt? That's nutty. But the danger with that sort of objection is, first of all, why would libertarian economists have a comparative advantage in understanding the climate system, right? So there's that issue that you sort of sound like you don't know what you're talking about. But also, if what our primary objection to a carbon tax and things like that, is to say, oh, that the science behind that is dubious, and I actually don't think it hurts other people if I burn a gallon of conventional gasoline and release CO2 into the atmosphere, if that's your first reaction, it makes it sound like you're saying if the science were correct, if these models were right, then maybe a global carbon tax instituted by worldwide governments would be a good idea. And presumably most anarcho-capitalists don't agree with that claim. So what I did in this paper was I walked through a framework for suppose we had a worldwide anarcho-capitalist system, or whatever you want to call it, framework, society, and suppose the scientists in that world actually did become convinced that, holy cow, if we keep emitting CO2 into the atmosphere, it's going to end up killing a billion people within two decades, you know, that kind of stuff. So suppose what the most alarmist scientists are saying, the ones who happen to be clamoring for government solutions today, what if the science behind their claims were correct in a Rothbardian framework? How would the world deal with that? Would there be some sort of market analog of a cap-and-trade system, for example? Would the private legal system develop property rights in the atmosphere and concentrations of CO2 so that you, if you were a factory and you were pumping CO2 in the atmosphere, would you have to pay someone for the right to do that? Would that be analogous to you dumping chemicals in the river where maybe that's the efficient outcome, but then you have to pay the owners of the river to give you permission to do that, right? So that's the framework I walked through. And the reason I thought it might be interesting to you guys in this course, and again, it's totally optional, is that I was forced to really talk about how would new types of property rights emerge in the face of a major technological change or the face of some major scientific breakthrough. So that's it, because the nature of property rights partly depends on physical reality. So things like can people own radio spectrum before humans even knew about radio spectrum? That wasn't even an issue. So John Locke wouldn't have been sitting around thinking, huh, can I own the station 105.4, the buzz? That wouldn't have even made sense to him because he wouldn't even know what that meant. Whereas now that we do have technology and we can broadcast stuff over radio waves, it at least is a coherent question to say, can somebody own a station? Or, you know, can somebody own the, you know, the frequencies from this wavelength to that wavelength, or whatever you want to say? So that's what I wanted to deal with, is to show, suppose you had private judges who were making rulings, and there was a body of private law that had developed the way we talk about in this course, and then all of a sudden the scientists are horrified to realize, oh my gosh, we have to do something about carbon emissions or we're all going to die. What would the worldwide market response to that be? So anyway, I walked through there, and the things I wrote in that essay, of course, aren't definitive, and this goes back to something I said in week one's lecture that, or we touched on it in the office hours, actually. I don't remember if I said this in week one's lecture, but there, it was in, I think, the John Hassness piece that was quoted in something that I gave you guys to say, you know, if I'm a free market economist and the dictator of North Korea comes and asks me for advice and says, geez, I can't feed my people. How come our standard of living is so low? What do we do? And I can say, well, you need to implement market reforms, start instituting widespread private property, blah, blah, blah. And then he wants me to get real specific and say, okay, well, then how many grocery stores would there be next quarter if I did what you tell me to do? Well, let me be sure before I go ahead with this crazy implementation of capitalism like you're suggesting, Murphy. I want you to convince me that the new system that would emerge would actually feed my people better than what we're doing right now, because otherwise I don't want to go down that path. So my honest response as an economist would have to be, I have no idea how many grocery stores there would be. That's something that the market has to determine. What I can do is give you general arguments and point you to all sorts of empirical evidence to say markets feed people better than socialism does. So I'm confident your people will have a higher standard of living and will be better fed under markets than they are right now, but I can't be crystal clear and sure about the specific outcome the market would generate. So it's the same thing here in that essay that I'm saying you guys can read if you're interested. I'm not sure that's how the world would deal with a genuine threat of man-made climate change. I'm just saying it might look like this, and it's mostly just to get the wheels turning so you can see how I picture market forces in a private legal system working, so you could have massive changes in the body of law in response to a completely new situation. Okay. Let's go ahead and dive then into tonight's lecture. So first of all, I had somewhat flippantly on Facebook, I believe, when you guys were still enrolling for this class, I said, hey, if we break 200, I'll explain what the deal is with Gene Callahan. Well, we actually, I don't know what the number is now, but we broke 200. So I suppose since I'm a man of integrity, I have to say something. So for those of you who don't even know what I'm talking about, Gene Callahan used to be a libertarian. He no longer calls himself a libertarian. In fact, he wrote a lot for Mises.org, and he was such a good communicator of the Austrian perspective that they had him write the introductory book, so that if you want to give one book to a layperson who said, what's the deal with this Austrian economics, what's it all about, this was the book, Economics for Real People by Gene Callahan. And then since then he's had a change of heart, and he no longer thinks Murray Rothbard is the best economist ever, to put it mildly. So anyway, I am not going to speculate on what caused Gene's change. What I will say for the purposes of our class tonight is that here's a picture of Gene before, and then here's a picture of Gene after the private defense agencies get a hold of him. So just keep that in mind, everybody, if you do decide to cross Rothbardians. All right. Let me talk about this issue of insurers versus guarantors. I saw somebody in the Moodle forum raise this issue saying, hey, what Dr. Murphy is calling insurance companies actually are guarantors. And that's fine to say that, And you're right, there is historical precedent and that sort of thing. So in many tribal, I don't know if tribal is the right word, let's say clan-based societies, there were things that looked kind of like pre-capitalist analogs of what I'm talking about when I talk about people having insurance companies vouch for them. All right. So, and you see it also in the sense of like fraternal organizations, perhaps. So even today, why my pen's not working. Okay. Even today, you have these things, fraternal organizations. So I don't mean like a frat house on a college campus necessarily, although even that could conceivably work, that, you know, if some guy who's a, you know, part of the Delta Tau Delta gets hammered and wrecks somebody's off-campus apartment, and then the people go and complain to the president of the Delts and says, hey, one of your members trashed my place last Friday, what's the story? It's possible to maintain their image in the community. They'll actually say, like, to the pledges or something, go fix up that guy's apartment, what the heck, and then go berate their member who did that. Okay, so, I mean, that's not unheard of that something like that might happen, and so that's part of, so it's sort of like the group polices itself. So if anybody that's in the group commits some sort of offense, whether it's an actual legal offense or just, hey, come on, that's out of line, that's not the kind of image we're trying to maintain in the community, then the group tried to make up for it so that the person who is the recipient of that either literal crime or uncool behavior is made whole, and then it's thinking, okay, these guys are fine. And then the group does whatever it does to the individual members. So that sort of model is what I'm going after, and the way I happen to formalize it in the book Chaos Theory was in the context of insurance companies, because I was saying that is exactly the relationship between a doctor and the insurance company for medical malpractice insurance. And it's also, all of you have the same thing if you drive. You have an insurance policy that you pay premiums for, and it doesn't merely protect you in case somebody hits you and your car gets dinged up and then the person flees the scene and now, oh my gosh, I got, my car got totaled and I don't know where the person went. What do I do? Well, if you have insurance, automobile insurance, they'll cover that, you know, after your deductible. But it also covers you in case you cause damage to somebody else. And that's why the government requires that if you're driving around, you at least have basic automobile insurance to cover damage you do to others, right? So I think the laws vary. I believe the government doesn't require that you actually be able to fix your own car if you get an accident, but you have to have a basic minimum coverage in case you cause damage to other people. So the idea is the government doesn't want you driving around if you smash into somebody and then you have no means, you have not beforehand taken steps to be able to compensate somebody that you victimize in that fashion. Okay, some people are saying in the comments certain states might not have that. I don't claim to be an expert in all 50 states, but clearly many states do have such regulations. And I think there might even be things analogous to that in a private setting. Right? So even if free market companies own roads and maintain them, I think a condition, and many of them, probably a condition of being on them, would be that you have some form of insurance, either insurance that you have separately that goes around with you wherever you go, or that technically when you pay for passage on the road, part of what you're buying is a little insurance policy covering you while you're on that road, and where the premium for that would vary depending on your past driving record. Right, so that's why they wouldn't just charge a flat fee for everybody, because they would want the portion of the fee they're charging you that covers the possibility in case you cause an 8-car pileup, and they want to be able, you know, they don't want to totally be on the hook for that. They want to charge you more if you've got 3 DUIs. And people say, well, a DUI is not a crime. Okay, well, if you have been in accidents and you were drunk when you got in the accident, that's certainly going to affect the way the road owner views you when considering how much should I charge this person to let them use my road. whereas somebody who's never even been in a fender bender is less of a risk to other potential customers. All right, so the road owner in a free society needs to worry about that stuff, and we're not sure where that pricing would come in, whether the road owner would take care of it or whether you'd have to personally have insurance from a big company that followed you around whatever road you were on, and then as a condition of you getting on the road, the owner of the road just verifies somehow that you have insurance. I mean, it could work like that. And maybe there's little dinky country roads in the middle of nowhere where they don't bother with that kind of stuff because they kind of know everybody who's likely to use it and it's not worth the transaction cost. But a major thoroughfare where there's millions of people in the vicinity and there's all kinds of nut jobs who might be driving on the road with all kinds of souped up vehicles, I think there would be, even in a free society, certain, you know, regulations on who can use those roads and what prices they pay. Okay, so anyway, what the point I'm making for this slide is to say right now, all of you, well, doctors and then all of you to the extent that you have a license and can drive in the 50 states, if you're in the United States, probably has car insurance, or if not, you're probably driving illegally. I know all of you are horrified at the thought of breaking government rules. And I'm explaining to you the nature of that. So that's why I used insurance as the model, because that's something that everybody would have firsthand experience with. And also, you clearly see the feedback mechanism where your past behavior influences your current premiums. Whereas in a more, and the other distinction too is that it's voluntary. Well, it's not voluntary to the extent that the government forces you to get it, but it's more, certainly a doctor, you don't have to become a doctor, right? So I'm saying if you go into that field and then for a hospital to be willing to hire you, you're going to need to get medical malpractice insurance. Even if there were no government regulations, a major hospital is going to, as part of its services that it's offering to the public, want to be in a position to say, if we screw up and kill your kid on the table, we'll give you $1 million or whatever it is based on how bad our screw-up is. And for them to be able to handle those potential liabilities, they're going to want to have insurance policies. All right, so, but that's all voluntarily entered into. So when you think through and say, why would a doctor do that? Why would a hospital do that? Clearly, it's because they're trying to attract more business. That if they have that other institution, namely the insurance company, vouching for them, backing them up, people are more likely then to say, okay, how much do you charge for brain surgery or for a heart valve replacement? Okay, I'm more comfortable now dealing with you because since you've got this insurance company on the hook, presumably the insurance would have checked you guys out and made sure your doctors had valid medical degrees. But, you know, the insurance company, if it's a major company, isn't going to come in and say, oh, yeah, anybody this hospital hires who kills you, and it can be proven in a legitimate private court with judges who know this kind of law, if they rule that it was gross negligence and that this was really almost criminal in the sense of what they did to you on the operating table, we'll make up for that. You know, we have reserves, we've been charging them premiums, and we'll pay you. Well, they're not going to put themselves on the hook like that unless they look at the hospital's procedures and they say, well, how do you hire a brain surgeon? What kind of vetting do you do? You know, do you just hire somebody because he sends in a nice resume, or do you actually have the guy do a residency, and do you look and talk to his previous employer? So before you go on the hook like that, you're going to really, as the insurance company, you're going to make sure this hospital has good safeguards in place to make sure some quack doesn't get a scalpel and get to start cutting people up. All right, so that's why I, in chaos theory, chose insurance is the mechanism for this. But as the person, I can't remember the guy's name, pointed out in the comments in the Moodle discussion, if it's easier for you, I mean, it might not actually take the form of insurance companies per se. It could also, a lot of this stuff that I'm talking about, these principles, could manifest themselves in the form of fraternal organizations. So, like, you know, it could be based on, it could be like a union almost. So maybe all of the carpenters in a certain area are part of this trade association, and part of what they do is they say, hey, if if any of our members rips you off, you know, like if they give you a quote for some work, they say, like you say, hey, I want a new deck, and they come and they quote you a price and say it'll be $3,000 or whatever, 2.5 ounces of gold. If we're in a free society, they're not going to be using dollars. And then the carpenter shows up, and it takes 2 weeks longer than the guy said it would, and then he threw on all these extra charges and said, well, that was the base price. I mean, I have to charge you for the nails and the lumber. I mean, I was just pricing you for my labor. What, are you kidding me? And then it ended up being twice as much, and the homeowner feels like he got defrauded by this carpenter. Well, if the carpenter is a member of this well-known trade association, like the Nashville Carpenters Union or something like that, or the Nashville Carpenters Association, or the Nashville Brotherhood of Carpenters, or whatever they call themselves, you can go to the representative of the association and lodge a complaint there and say, hey, one of your members took advantage of me, and I'm really unhappy. And if you don't fix this, I'm going to tell all my neighbors, don't you ever do business with somebody who's a member of this fraternal organization or this trade group. So it's in the interest of the trade group to make sure you're happy. Now, if you're just crazy, if the carpenter performed exactly as he said he would, and he can document everything, and you signed the initial estimate, you signed off on it, and then he showed the bill he gave you and the personal check you gave him, and can show the trade group, this guy's crazy. You know, I did exactly what I said. I charged him what I said I was gonna, and here's the photos of the finished deck. Look at it, it's gorgeous. I didn't do it. Well, then they're gonna dismiss the guy's complaint and say, we can't. Sorry, this guy did, according to our internal review, what he did was fine. And if the guy wants to go around to his neighbors bad-mouthing you, there's nothing they can do about that. But the point is, if it's a legitimate complaint, then the trade group's going to make it right. You know, they'll either refund some of the money themselves out of their own dues and, you know, the war chest they've accumulated, or if it was shoddy work, somebody else from the trade group will go to the guy's house and fix the deck for free. And then, of course, you know, the trade group will pay that guy out of their general funds. So when you say, wait a minute, okay, that's cool, but where does the trade group get its funding from? And they say, well, they get them from the members. Every month, to be a member of this trade group, not only do you have to prove your competence, like, you know, show that you went to a certain school or that you worked for X years under this other master carpenter as an apprentice, and he can vouch for you and say, oh, yeah, this kid's good. I showed him everything I know, blah, blah, blah. He worked on me on these three big jobs. He's ready to start on his own, and so forth. So not only do they verify that you've got the skills to be a good carpenter and they want to have you in their ranks, but you also pay dues to be a member of their club. So that's where they get the money to fund, you know, their managerial positions, to whatever brochures they're going to make up, whatever website they're going to maintain. They need to get money to do that somehow. And if there are complaints that they need to rectify, they need money to be able to do that, either to compensate the homeowner if the homeowner thought he was overcharged for work that's good work, but he got charged too much, or if the homeowner thinks, oh, man, this deck looks awful, or he's going to build me a treehouse, and look at this thing, it's ridiculous. And so then the trade group needs to send new guys to the site to fix it and do it right. Well, they need money to do that. So they get the money not from the community, from their own members by charging them dues. And so then you say, well, wait a minute. Why would any carpenter pay money to be part of a group that at best will leave them alone and at worst will reprimand them? In other words, part of what you're doing when you join this group is you're saying, I promise to follow by this code of conduct, that I agree any member of the Nashville Association of Expert Carpenters has these bullet points that we adhere to. The customer is always first. We only use high-quality wood. We always, you know, weather-treat our finished products so that they can last 3 years in the rain, blah, 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 you know, all this stuff. And if there's any dispute, I agree to abide by the rulings of the internal adjudication board maintained by the Nashville Brotherhood of Expert Carpentry, or whatever the heck I called it. So it looks like there's nothing but downside if you're a carpenter and you're considering joining this group. They have all sorts of rules and regulations they're imposing on you. They have the ability perhaps to fine you if you do something wrong, you know, that they might fine you. So that could be another mechanism by which they recoup their costs. So if they have to pay somebody $2,000 because you overcharged them, yeah, it comes out of their general fund, but then maybe what they do is they say to you, if you still want to be a member with us, you owe us $2,000 in addition to your normal monthly fee because we just had to pay that. It's not fair that everybody else has to pick that burden up. It's your fault. You overcharge the guy. So why would you ever agree to be a member? Because it gets you more business. It looks good for you as a carpenter when you're out giving bids on jobs and you can, and you're charging more than some other guy, and the homeowner says, well, this guy says he can give me a beautiful deck. You say he can give me a beautiful deck, and he's charging 1 gold ounce less than you are. Why would I go with you? You can say, because I'm a member of the Nashville Brotherhood of Expert Carpenters, and this guy isn't. You don't know who this guy is. What if he just takes your money and skips town, or what if he just builds you an awful deck, or what if he builds you a deck, and then after one summer of the sun, the thing is all disgusting, you know, changes color on you. And he told you he weather-treated it and wouldn't do that. What are you going to do then if you can't find him 6 months from now? Whereas you know the Nashville Brotherhood of Expert Carpenters has been around for 10 years. It's going to be around 6 months from now. If I do a bad job and you don't even realize it until later, or you know, 3 months later, all of a sudden there's termites all over the thing, and I told you that I treated it for termites, but I lied, and I just pocketed that money you paid me. You know, that kind of stuff, if problems develop over time, you can be assured that the Nashville Brotherhood of Expert Carpenters is sitting right here, and you complain to them. And even if I'm dead, or even if I'd moved to Bermuda, they pledge any work done by someone who is in our ranks at the time of the work is vouched for by us, and we will make you whole if there's any problem down the road, you know, according to these criteria. You can't just say 2 years later, you know what, I don't like the color of that. I wish he had done it a different, you know, that you can't do that. But that's the sort of thing. So the homeowner is more comfortable paying more and giving you the job. So that's why you would be a member of that trade association. All right. So you see what I'm saying? This principle of being part of a group that gives a signal to the rest of the community and maintains certain standards, that's a more general principle than just insurance companies. And those sorts of things, I think, also would fill a lot of the gap in what would initially be this sort of vacuum if the government just disappeared tomorrow. And then we had all these things that previously were regulated by the state, all sorts of codes of conduct and statutes laying out obligations and so forth, and what a person's redress is if somebody has done him or her wrong. Without the state, it's like, oh my gosh, what do I do? All these potential bad actors out there who are going to hurt me or steal my money, rip me off in some way, how do I protect myself? Well, I think the way a free society would do it is you'd start having clusters of reputable organizations develop. People, entrepreneurial, would see there is a need to establish these standards of excellence in some narrow discipline, and then that's what we're going to start doing. So you'd have it with trade groups, you'd have it with businesses, so like, and right now you see examples of it. For example, you guys may have seen, like, on electronic products, they'll have this symbol UL, which is for, I think it's called Underwriters Laboratories. So it's this private group that certifies electronics products. Like, they test it and stuff and make sure if it's like a radio that you're supposed to be able to play in the bathroom. Well, it better be okay that if the plug is in like a little bit of water from you brushing your teeth, that it doesn't blow up on you. If it's supposed to be a radio designed for use in the bathroom, and so they test that kind of stuff, and they'll put the UL logo on it. Or, you know, you may have heard of what is it, Consumer Reports? Is that the name of that magazine? So people who are looking at a certain product could go to Consumer Reports. I think right now this happens. So I'm saying this sort of stuff would just proliferate and be more advanced in a free society. Okay, one last thing here. I typed it up because I didn't want to forget it. But notice that in a free society, think through the distinction between healthcare versus healthcare insurance. So you'd have, when you say, oh, gee, we don't have a state, what do we do? What about healthcare? and obviously there's people who believe in the power of the free market. And so that's easy. If people are sick and other they have a need, they're willing to pay people who can alleviate their sickness, or they want to stay healthy, so they're willing to pay people for annual checkups and things like that. And then you have other people who have a comparative advantage in providing healthcare services, and then they amplify that by going to medical school and so forth and studying and becoming even better providers of healthcare services. So that is the fundamental market. That's the explanation for how does healthcare get provided in a market. And then you say, well, what's the role then of insurance? Would insurance have anything to do with healthcare? And yeah, it would. I think insurance has taken on a far too large role in today's world because of government intervention and so forth and the tricky things with the tax code. But even in a totally free market, there would certainly be health insurance. It would be more of the catastrophic form. So it wouldn't be your insurance company pays every time you go and get a checkup. That's silly. But it would be if all of a sudden you have a heart attack and you need triple bypass surgery and it's a huge medical bill, that probably there would be insurance packages covering that sort of thing. So, but notice the distinction there. There's the basic need or desire that people have for healthcare services, and then other people can be suppliers of it. And then just as a refinement to that kind of market, because there are certain expenses that are really high, or from the doctor's point of view, they want to be able to pledge to people in case it's found that I've treated you wrong, now I have this thing called malpractice insurance. That's how insurance comes in around the edges and makes it even more refined. So that is the analogy with private law. And like I said last week, just to emphasize again, this is something that my own view has evolved since writing Chaos Theory. That in Chaos Theory, I jumped into insurance right away and contracts right away, and now I realize that's a mistake. That when you start and say, what if the state just disappeared? What would come in and fill that void? Just like you say, oh, well, there's a need for medical care, and then doctors would come along, and then people who had a natural aptitude for that would then go to school and study it and become better, and there'd be companies that would hire doctors, and they would have name brand recognition, and then there'd be insurance companies coming along the way too. By the same token, what is the basic raw need in a society for law? It is to have judges come along and give opinions on settling disputes over property rights. And so that's what I think the fundamental thing is, and that's the basic market from scratch, or the bedrock, is that people would have disputes with each other that we would recognize from our perspective as an argument over property rights to say, hey, whose property is that? Do I have the right to blare my speaker at 2 a.m. because, hey, I own my house and I own my speakers? Or does my next door neighbor have the right to have peace and quiet at 2 a.m. because, hey, I own my house and I'm trying to sleep here. I got to get up for work in the morning. You can't be throwing a wild party next door. That's crazy. You're violating my – there's a dispute over property rights. It's not enough just to know I own my house. Okay, so what does that mean? Does that mean you can blare music that the sound waves literally leave your property? And if you say no, that you don't have the right to do that, well, then where does that principle end? Do I have to stop my heart from beating? Because technically someone next door, if he has really sophisticated equipment, can hear my heartbeat. If he, points something like the FBI might have at my house or something, he might be able to hear my heartbeat. So am I violating his property rights because the sound waves from my heart are leaving the borders of my property? And can he go to court and say, I want this guy to pay me to continue having his heartbeat? Most people would say, no, that's crazy. That you own your body, you don't have to pay someone else for the right to have your heartbeat. So this kind of stuff, you can't solve these things just through sitting in your armchair and thinking it through from first principles. There are empirical issues and stuff comes up and it's not clear, is it pure matter of logic, what the bundle of property rights are or is when you say I own my house and I own the land on which the house sits. It's not clear. Can a plane fly overhead? What about a satellite that's in orbit that technically goes between my house and the moon for 3 seconds every night in its orbit? can I say that impedes my view of the moon, and therefore I can sue the owner of the set? Stuff like this. It's not clear how this should be decided. So these are the disputes, and the private judges come along who specialize in these various areas and offer their opinion. And how do they? How does that market even and get going? It's because they, in the first place, some of them just have, they seem very wise and fair and judicious in the everyday sense of the term. Just like if you started from scratch and there were no medical schools and someone's got a cut, well, who's he going to let fix it? Well, some guy who seemed like he did pretty good fixing up other people's cuts previously. And he seemed like he was real gentle and seemed like he knew what he was doing. So the same thing here, if it just got thrown open and we had no legacy at all and everybody just had amnesia and no one remembered anything from the previous legal order and all these disputes arise, some people would come along in the community and say, you know, it seems to me a fair way to resolve this is such and such. And then other people in the community would say, oh yeah, that sounds pretty nice. That seems like a reasonable way to settle that. What do you guys say? And it, things like that, and that would start establishing the precedent in the body of law. And then over time, that would get systematized and refined. People would start going to law school. People would start writing books codifying all these legal principles. Scholars would start debating it. And then insurance companies would come along. And they would start saying, given now this growing body of law and these legal principles, now that it's become established that if you are driving your car and you're drunk and you go off the road and run over a family and kill them all, you owe them a bunch of money or their estate a bunch of money. You know, now there's a role for an insurance company to come along and say, okay, if you're driving a car, we will insure up to 700 ounces of gold or whatever liability, then that sort of thing. So that's, again, in chaos theory, I was short-sighted in that I was thinking it was contracts and insurance that was the bedrock, and now I realize that, no, that just comes in after. The bedrock is people just start offering opinions, and then over time, they get so good at it that people start paying them to give their opinions on a legal dispute. Okay, what about prison? How does this work? So a lot of what I've been talking about sounds very plausible in the context of choose my words here. Everyday disputes among people who are fairly reasonable. And yes, people are biased. Everybody always, when they're in an argument, thinks they're in the right and the other person is a jerk. But so far, I've been telling you these issues in the context of two neighbors who are having a fight over a party or something like that, where they're otherwise civilized people. You might see them in church, you see them in the grocery store, and come. But then people say, all right, fine, your system, Murphy, might be more moral. It's more voluntary. We grant you that. There's less coercion involved. We grant you that. It's perhaps more efficient. But you would need a society of generally law-abiding people who just have honest disagreements over what the laws are. But what about the hardcore 0.1% of the population who doesn't care what the law is, and they knowingly violate it? So serial rapists or bank robbers or axe murderers, it's not that they just were, oh, I'm sorry, it wasn't legal for me to chop your head off? I didn't realize. I thought the property right in my axe extended to your neck. My mistake. I won't do it again. I just, you know, I read John Locke, and that was my interpretation. That's not the issue. So what does the society I'm talking about have to do with that sort of nightmare scenario? Okay, let me, before I even go down this path, let me just point something out here. We have serial killers and rapists now in this society. Right, so it is not my job as someone who's advocating or explaining how what I call a free society would work. The burden of proof is not on me to show there will never be a serial killer ever in the history of Ancapistan. That's an unacceptably high burden of proof, because right now there's serial killers all the time in our current world, with the government having laws on the books against murder. taxing people heavily to fund massive police forces, having an FBI, having all kinds of security and surveillance, having drones now observing us. So the trade-off is not, or the question is not to say, the state right now protects us from serial killers. Murphy, it's up to you to prove to me that the market could protect us from serial killers too. And if whatever you say, if I can dream up some scenario in which a serial killer would evade the sort of incentives and mechanisms you talk about and would get away with killing 7 people, and it might take a few years to catch the guy, well, then I reject your system out of hand. I say, it won't work. And that's, I'm not setting up a straw man. That's what people do. I mean, believe me, in grad school when I was working through this stuff, I'd argue on forums all the time with people, and that was what they were doing. They thought they had disposed of the Rothbardian project by pointing out that it's hypothetically possible there could be a rapist in a Rothbard world. And, oh, therefore, private defense, private security doesn't work because you can't guarantee to me that that a woman will never get raped, or you can't guarantee to me that a bank will never get robbed. Therefore, next, your idea stinks, we'll move on. And that's crazy. The proper comparison is to say it's a relative institutional framework for a given population, people who have a certain degree of violence and aggression and willingness to hurt others in order to achieve personal gain. For a given population, the anarchist claim is there will be fewer aggressions against person and property if you have a voluntary market-provided legal framework and enforcement process, as opposed to having a monopoly group do that. And this is why it's so absurd when people say stuff, and we'll come back to this in week 4 when we go over the objections, but let me just talk about it now because I've set the point up so well. When people say stuff like, oh, you like anarchy, why don't you go to Somalia then? So you're telling me you'd rather live in Somalia than live in Tampa? What are you, nuts? And that's the silliest apples to oranges comparison. Because living in Somalia when there was a government was worse than living in Somalia right now under relative anarchy. So what the anarchist is claiming, or the Rothbardian anarchist is claiming, is that living in Tampa with no government would be better than living in Tampa right now with a government. So yes, I can imagine, if I'm on some island somewhere and I'm with a bunch of zombies and there's no government, that might be a pretty awful scenario. But by the same token, if I'm on an island with a bunch of zombies and then they have a government and they get to tax me as well as eat me, or they get to vote on whether they're going to eat me or not, well, that's even worse. So that's, just make sure you do that comparison. So here, the system I'm going to talk about and how a free society would deal with genuine antisocial individuals who, you've got to do something with these people. You can't just let them walk around and fine them, that kind of thing. It's the point here isn't to prove that therefore I've solved the problem of axe murderers. The point is to prove that this, I think, is a better way of dealing with them, and there would be fewer serial killers in a society like I'm painting a picture of compared to the present society. Okay, so first of all, anybody who is associated with or has firsthand experience with actual prisons in the United States knows they are awful places. They are not well run, and they actually produce more criminals, right? That there are all kinds of studies showing that somebody who, especially for like nonviolent drug offenses, I mean, this is just absurd that some kid is a mid-level drug dealer and he goes to prison, maybe because of some three strikes you're out rule, and he goes to prison for a long time, and then he's in there with actual killers and stuff, or guys who have been in organized crime, and then what ends up happening? It toughens them up. It makes them very bitter. Maybe awful things happen to him while he's in prison, and so that totally warps his view of human beings and his opinion as to what do you have to do to get by in this world and how should you treat people. And the guys he talks to on a day-to-day basis are all expert criminals, and they give them tips, and they say, okay, when we get out of here, here's my number, call me up and we'll do a job or something, right? So I'm painting with broad strokes here, but if the goal of prison is to rehabilitate people, it's an awful approach, what we're doing right now in society. with the government scheme. And if you're curious to read more, this guy Dan D'Amico has done a lot of good work. He's an Austrian economist. So that Daniel D'Amico, D with an apostrophe, A-M-I-C-O, he's done a lot of good stuff on prisons and how the state approach to them is totally screwed up. Just to give you one example, there are prisons where they'll outlaw tattoos. And they'll say you can't, or you can't have any sort of gang signs. And there's arguments to say that, well, actually, you're screwing things up. That there was a natural social order that had sort of developed sort of a balance of power, and people would join different gangs, and then they wouldn't mess with each other because they knew it would be an all-out war, and it was kind of like a detente or something. And then the government comes in, the prison warden comes in and says, oh, we don't want to have tattoos on people and showing off gang signs because that's going to lead to fights. But now that signaling mechanism gets all screwed up, and then people can't be sure. And so maybe you fight somebody in a cafeteria because you didn't think he was a member of a gang, so you thought he was up for grabs, and then but he was a member of a gang. So now the gang is obligated to go retaliate because you just attacked one of our members. So it's just standard classic government stupidity where they think if they pass a rule, they would have just changed the underlying reality. Just like they say, we don't like all these people using heroin, so let's make it illegal. Well, people still want to use heroin. Now it just gets distorted. Same thing, if you've got a prison that's got two powerful gangs and they occasionally skirmish with each other, by coming in and saying, okay, now you're not allowed to have gang signs anymore, they're still in their heads, they're still members of their gangs. You didn't just all of a sudden obliterate their membership. Now it just makes it harder for them to identify each other. And so it's more likely that an accidental escalation will occur. All right, so anyway, like I said, this guy Dan D'Amico has done a lot of good work on that. If you want to see more specifics about what is it about state control of prisons per se that makes it really screwed up. I was at Pork Fest recently, and Dan gave a great talk talking about certain prisons that the wardens were cool, and they were implementing programs where the prisoners got to engage in commerce. Like they got to make things and then sell them. Like they'd have these bazaars where outsiders would come to the prison, I'm making this up, like let's say every third month or something, and buy all the knickknacks that the inmates had made. And some of the inmates were very creative, and knowing that they were going to have this event in 3 months to sell their wares to the public, that would focus their energies because they actually had something to do with their lives besides just sit there and look at the wall and count off the time. And so they'd get into that, and that would channel their aggression, and they would be occupied doing that instead of making a shiv to attack the guy in a cafeteria. And they would do that, and they would make money. And so this was a great thing, and the amount of prisoner violence went down, and everybody was well-behaved, and it was just beautiful. And then a higher level of government came along and said, no, stop doing that. And I don't know what the reasoning was. If you're cynical, you'd say because the government wants prisons to be hellholes, that they like that. But if you're less cynical, you would just say, well, that's bureaucracy for you. But either way, the point is there are cases of prisons implementing reforms within the warden's own jurisdiction where he had the power of something that made life inside the prison much better, more tolerable, and the government at a higher level came in and overrode it, stopped doing that. Okay, so part of what I'm saying is if you haven't looked into it much, you need to realize the way governments run prisons right now is kind of like the way governments run schools. So many of us know that government involvement in education is not a great thing, and that, oh, wow, well, at least the government does a good job educating kids, and now our job as a free market economist is to explain why the market could do a decent job too to match this wonderful job of teaching that the government does. Did you say no? It's horrible. It's the same thing with prisons. It would be hard for the free society to come up with a system, a penal mechanism that was more disgusting and more likely to cause further crime and make the situation worse than what the government does. And especially if you go into other countries. I mean, even here, this is a relatively free society in many respects. And we have this awful prison system. I mean, you go to some other more dictatorial regimes where they torture everybody who goes to prison and so forth. It's even worse. Okay, but now that I've given that framework and I've emphasized how low the bar is for a free society to get over, to have a better approach to genuine sociopaths than the government approach, what is my approach? All right, so I outlined it in chaos theory. Let me just talk about it with you guys here. What I think would happen is you have to realize, so somebody is a lawbreaker. Somebody commits crimes. Somebody's going around with a shotgun and starts blowing people away. And he goes into a movie theater or whatever, starts shooting people. How does the system deal with that? Well, instantly, all the people who own that property can just say, get off my land. I mean, so that's the way they have the legal right to talk to this person. They don't need a judge to come in and rule on whether the guy is a criminal or not. They can just say, this is my land. I have the right to tell people whether they're a trespasser or not. And I'm saying, you're a trespasser. Get off my land. But, and so in our society right now, the most that would do for you is push the guy onto the street or the sidewalk that the government technically owns. And then it would be an issue of, oh, gee, now what do we as a society want to do with this guy? Because now he's on public land. But there's no such thing as public land in the sort of society we're talking about. Everybody, every piece of property is owned by some group, by some individual or some group privately. So even if he gets out of the movie theater, he's now on the street. And the street owner presumably isn't fine with some guy who just shot up a movie theater walking around the street carrying a shotgun that's loaded. That he would say that, you know, stop. So the point is, you instantly would become a pariah, and nobody would want you on their property, and there would be mechanisms in place that would be part of precedent to say, if I want you to get off my property and you're carrying a loaded weapon, and especially if I've just seen you use it, then I have the legal right to use all sorts of measures to get you off my property. And so, that I think is the foundational way that so if the guy with the shotgun who just shot up a movie theater then objects later to his treatment and tries to bring a lawsuit against the burly guys with flak jackets who did something to him, he would have no legal standing because it would be clear in the private body of law that had developed over time through voluntary rulings given by judges that a property owner, part of the bundle of rights, yeah, maybe you can't blast your stereo at 3 a.m., and that would depend on the nature of your residence and so forth, but clearly what it means to say I'm the owner of this piece of land and I own this building or I own this apartment complex is to say if there's a guy with a shotgun standing on it and I tell him to get off and he doesn't, I can then hire some other firm to come in with guys with flak jackets to tackle him or to push him back or to shoot him if he raises his gun at them. And then he has no legal standing. If he sues them, no judge is going to say, yeah, you're right, you guys owe him money when he was pointing a gun at you guys and had already demonstrated his willingness to shoot innocent people. Okay, so that's the legality of it. But now, what about prison? And so here, I think libertarians who want to just sort of centrally plan the whole legal system run into trouble. That they want to just sit from the first principles and say, well, okay, we have the right of self-ownership, and then if I mix my labor with something, I own the stuff that I created, and I can exchange, and then and therefore, if someone shoots somebody, guys can come and grab him and put him in a cage for 6.7 years, as long as he's been judged guilty by a jury of 12 of his peers. There's no way you're going to come up with that sort of specific thing popping out of the end, of that logical deduction. And so I think the way in practice the market would evolve and you would have something that is like prison in a society that we're calling free is that you've got these people now who find themselves in this untenable situation. They have just done something because the guy is on drugs or he's just mentally imbalanced or he's just has no conscience and he didn't see a problem with going into a theater and opening up fire. Whatever reason, you're now in this position where nobody and civilized society wants anything to do with you, everyone is going to say, get off my property, I'm calling the private security forces, and that's their job, is they send guys with flak jackets and, you know, bulletproof helmets and whatever to come and take you down. And what are they going to do with you? Well, without this institution of prison that I'm going to talk about in a second, I guess they could take you to the edge of society and dump you in the ocean. And even there, technically, somebody would own the ocean, but they might say, yeah, I don't, you know, you're not going to hurt my dolphins. Go ahead and dump him in there because he's going to drown. I don't care. But the point is, if no landowner wants you on his land, they're going to, you're going to get ferried to the edge of civilization and get dumped off. So rather than that, I think what would happen is you could have prisons, but they would be like hotels. They would be vying for your business as a pariah. You'd have different buildings that would be established that would say, hey, if you're a social pariah, if you're literally an outlaw, meaning you've sort of forfeited your right to standard legal protection because you were just killed a bunch of people in plain broad daylight and so forth, come here, we'll treat you with compassion, you know, no one's going to rape you inside of our cells or whatever. They wouldn't even call them cells, they'd call them rooms or something. But the one thing that they would have to be sure of is that when you come in and you sign something saying, I agree, I'm going to come and stay here, my ability to leave the facility, though, is going to be interrupted until, you know, my legal status can be ascertained. We'll provide you with legal counsel in case you think you've been treated unfairly, blah, 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 blah. You'll have access to be able to work. Like, if you're, you know, depending on what your job skills are, it's going to be in the interest of the people running this building to have you working so you can pay them. You know, they might charge you a lot of money depending on what the supply and demand situation is. So they're not going to want you to sit in a corner doing nothing and just lifting weights and making license plates. How does that – who does that benefit if you're just sitting around staring at the wall? That doesn't do anything. That makes you go nuts, and it doesn't help anybody in society, least of all the person you victimized. But if you're in there and you're a computer programmer, you can still be a computer programmer. They can give you a terminal, whatever. You can do your job. So you can still earn an income. And then maybe you can work off the debt you may have incurred. Like if a judge says, you just shot up that movie theater, I rule against you because I looked at the evidence, the surveillance tapes, and you're guilty. The standard penalties for, you know, first-degree homicide like that, premeditated murder, are 100 gold ounces per victim, and so you owe such and such to all these different estates of all these different people you killed. This is the legal thing. Now, if you were part of some fraternal organization, they would make it whole. They would pay the victims, and then they would just have to settle up with you. Or if you weren't a member, then you'd have to work it off in prison. But the point is, if you're right now, if nobody wants you on their land, this prison would be a haven for you. And so you go there. And so there's competition among these places. So that's why there wouldn't be sadistic guards. That's why you wouldn't have to worry that if you went in there that they're going to put you in a room where your roommate is crazy and you have to worry about getting killed in the middle of the night, because these places would be vying for your business as a social pariah. They would want you to come there, and you would work there, or if you had money somewhere, you'd pay them out of your funds to stay there, because if they weren't doing a good job, you'd go somewhere else. So it's true, it's not a place where you can come and go freely, but given that you're in there, they want to make sure it's tolerable, and they want to make it as amenable to you as they can. And you say, well, what's the constraint then? Why would the prison not want you leaving? Well, because in order to get the community to be happy with you having your prison right there, they would probably, you know, the neighboring groups or whatever would probably want some sort of guarantor organization to come along and vouch for those people and say, hey, it's cool, we're going to build a prison here. Or they probably wouldn't use the word prison, they'd probably use some other euphemism and say, yeah, we're going to have this place here, this rehabilitation home or something. And they'd give it some cheesy name probably, because that's what capitalism is about. It's about making things sound real palatable, right? Marketing's great. So they'd give it some great brand name marketing or whatever, make it sound real attractive to the community. And the way they would get people to be okay with it is they would say, so they would need some insurance company or some guarantor organization to come in and say, you know what, if anybody in here escapes and does anything, like on the way out of town, takes you over at gunpoint, carjacks you, whatever, we will compensate you. And so that's why you as the community should be more willing to let us build this place here, because we're reassuring everyone. So now if you're that guarantor organization or that insurance company, you're going to make sure you can't escape from this prison. If you're going to be on the hook now for all the serial killers that are inside these walls, you're going to make sure they can't break out. And so you're going to look at their, you know, the physical layout. You're going to see, well, what's your procedure for hiring guards? Let me make sure these guys aren't getting paid off and they're going to leave the cell door open at 3 o'clock tomorrow, a Tuesday, for this coordinated jailbreak, blah, blah, blah. They're going to do that. And if there is something analogous to parole, it's a similar thing. In order for you to get paroled, in order for anybody to trust you, like if I'm an employer and I know you've in the past been convicted of a serious violent crime, I'm going to be very hesitant to hire you. But if you have now someone vouching for you, some outside group, now I might be more willing, especially if you're going to be like in a controlled environment or something. Like, I'm not going to let you be at a daycare center, but maybe I'll let you work at a factory with a bunch of other guys who are pretty tough, so that probably the worst thing that's going to happen is you might get into a fist fight, you know, that sort of thing. So if you have some group vouching for you, now I'm more likely to do it. And so these groups then would specialize in rehabilitated prisoners, and they would have psychologists and therapists and maybe religious people if somebody, you know, found religion inside jail and now says, I'm a new man, and they would have people trained to see, is this legit or is this guy just saying this to get out of here? So that's the kind of thing. So it's not, the way I'm picturing it, it's not that you do a certain crime and then you do the time. Like, oh, you did this, so now you get eight years in prison. It's more the reason you're in prison is because right now, given your status, the market outcome is nobody wants you on their property, and this is the only place for you to go. So how do you alleviate that? There's all kinds of things you could do to convince people to be more willing to give you a second chance. And in particular, you don't need to convince everybody in society. What you really need to do is convince these groups that vouch for former prisoners, because that's what their business is. And you know, they specialize in knowing who actually is reformed and who actually is going to go back to drugs and end up robbing a bank again 2 weeks after they get let out. So notice, so the rate of recidivism, if you know that word, is going to be much lower. Whereas now in the present system, if somebody gets paroled and they go kill somebody, it's not like the government officials who made that decision have their pay docked. I mean, the absolute worst is maybe they're going to get fired if they do that too much and they make horrible decisions, but there's not this direct mechanism. Whereas the guarantor organization or the insurance company that comes in and specializes in rehabilitation of former convicts, and again, they wouldn't even use the word convict, they would use some euphemism, they're directly on the line. If somebody goes out and kills again, that they said, yeah, let him out, we vouch for the guy, we think he's seen the error of his ways, you know, like some guy who, he came home, he was drunk, and he found his wife in bed with his best friend, and oh my gosh, he was coming home from a hunting trip, and he had a loaded gun, and he just went nuts and shot him. But the guy's really not a killer. This is a crazy set of circumstances. We've talked to the guy. He's expressed remorse. You know, he's been in touch with his wife's parents, and they forgive him, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And really, so we vouch for him. And then he goes out and he kills again, because actually the guy really was a murderer at heart. Well, that insurance company now is out the money to compensate those people, the families of the people he just killed again. So, yeah, it's not perfect, but the point is the incentives are aligned so that these companies have every reason to really be careful before they say, let this guy out if he's been convicted of murder. All right, let me move on because we got a lot of other material to go through here. Okay, so let's push this analysis of a private legal system deeper, some of these topics. All right, what about the objection or this issue of, hey, there's multiple legal codes? So first of all, let's just get over the fact that this is not unique to anarcho-capitalism. There's multiple legal codes right now with state provision of law, right? That in the 50 states, there's all kinds of different legal codes depending on which state you're in. For example, just an obvious one, the death penalty. Sorry, I did something wrong. All right, so that's the, in the 50 states right now, some states have the death penalty, some don't. And you just know in certain states, it's not going to be advantageous, or if you're going to be convicted of a certain crime, people would know, oh man, you don't want to get convicted, whatever, I'm making this up, in Alabama for that, you're going to get on the chain gang. Whereas in other states, that might not be the case. Okay, I think I just turned, sorry, I hit the wrong button. Something weird was going on. I think I turned it off. Okay. So, yeah, you guys just saw for a moment what it was like to be me, to see the world from my eyes. Okay. So, and the same thing, too, even more generally, the world as a whole, right? It's somebody who says, oh, your anarcho-capitalist system, that's crazy, because you would have multiple legal codes. You'd have one body of law pertaining to this group over here, and then you'd have another body of law pertaining to this group over here. That doesn't make any sense to me. That's crazy. I'm, you know, just stop talking. Let me go back to my status legal framework because that makes sense to me. And the point is, okay, then you just admitted the only thing that could ever possibly work is if we had one world government in your mind, because we couldn't possibly have status laws applying in the United States and a different set of status laws applying in Mexico and then Canada. That would be crazy. How could those people ever deal with each other? What happens if some guy from Mexico shoots a guy in the United States? You need to have one body of law, otherwise people's heads explode. So therefore, if you believe in status law for the United States because otherwise your head explodes, well then now you're committed to one world government. And so maybe the person will call your bluff and say, yeah, exactly, that's great. That's why I work for the Bilderbergs. But most people will recoil from that. And they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm not saying you need one world government. I'm just saying, you know, and then it becomes a matter of degree. And they realize, oh, it's not so much that I need it to be over the whole planet Earth, but I kind of just think it needs to be bigger than what you're talking about. But now you can start pushing it and saying, okay, let's get more specific. So you agree. We can have multiple legal codes side by side. You just think that the legal code has to have some homogeneity within a certain geographical area. But once you've conceded the principle that you're okay with there being one legal code for the U.S. and another one for Canada, why couldn't you have one legal code for the people who believe in an eye for an eye within what we now call the U.S. in a different legal code pertaining to people who believe in pacifism, right? So what's the logical, you see the point there that there's nothing in principle about different legal codes that makes the geographical location change the argument. Now, one thing in fairness is that you might say, well, the issue is, I want to minimize interactions across different codes. Okay, so let me back up and make sure you guys are following me here. So I'm doing like this hypothetical argument with somebody who initially says to me, the anarcho-capitalist, whoa, that's crazy. Your system has multiple legal codes, and we all know to have the rule of law, there's just got to be one body of law that applies to everybody. End of story. Your system doesn't give that, or it doesn't. I'm not guaranteed. I'm not sold on the fact that your system would give me that, so therefore, you're nuts. And I'm going back with the system I know, which is a government or a state providing law. So the first response to that is to say, right now, your system doesn't give that. There's different legal codes in the states. There's clearly different legal codes all over planet Earth. So are you saying, really, you're only going to be satisfied with one world government? The person can come back and say, no, that's actually not what I'm saying. All I mean is things run more smoothly if most people on a day-to-day basis interact with other people that are under the same legal framework. So most Mexicans just deal with other Mexicans on a day-to-day basis. If you're in Mexico and somebody commits a crime against you, the person probably is going to be in Mexico. And also, so they're minimizing that. So you do have the benefits of a coherent, consistent legal framework applying to most Earthlings most of the time, with the current system of having geographical monopolies that are often quite large, administered by a single unit of government that we call the state. And so yeah, there's different states and they all have their own different legal codes, but they're kind of big. And then under the umbrella of any given state, you know what you're getting. And then also you can kind of know beforehand what you're getting into, because you can know, hey, if you don't like the kind of law they do in Venezuela, then don't go down there. Right. So if the person now says that, well, then I can come back and say, well, there's something very analogous to that, you know, in this sort of framework also, that a lot of your interactions on a day-to-day basis can be, you can protect yourself, right? So you can say, you know, I'm only going to go to a neighborhood where the other neighbors agree to this basic minimum criteria of a certain code of behavior. And a property developer, for example, some guy who goes and buys land out in the middle of nowhere and develops it and then has road companies come in and build roads to come out to this subdivision and so on, it would be more profitable for him to sell all those units to different households, to different buyers, if people coming into this new neighborhood could be assured that there was this basic minimum decency standard set, so that they wouldn't have to worry that, oh, the guy two houses down, actually, you know what, funny thing, he worships Satan and in his mind is perfectly fine to grab 8-year-olds and sacrifice them in his basement. So just be aware, a little FYI. Who the heck is going to buy a house in that neighborhood? Nobody. Except possibly Satanists, right? And then, okay, well, that's where all the Satanists would go. Problem solved. But you see the point. So it's not that everybody living in that neighborhood would have to agree on all the religious views, would have to agree with every last little detail, but they would have to agree, okay, you can't grab little kids off the street, that's kidnapping and that's illegal and that gets punished, right? So people could adhere to different legal codes, and when you go to work a different employer or different jobs, different employers might have different standards. So in one building, you know, if it's a big factory that has a bunch of guys that are real crude and everything, I mean, it might just kind of be known coming into this place that, yeah, you're going to get whistled at. Like if you're a woman and you come in here, you're going to get whistled at and stuff, and it's just not profitable for us to deal with that. We're not going to go through and punish guys and fire them if they start hitting on you, just because the kind of work we're doing here, the kind of guy that's going to apply for this position, we just can't weed that out. And it's just going to be the final product would be too expensive for us to insist on guys who behave like perfect gentlemen in this factory. And so maybe the market outcome is just a bunch of boors end up working at this place. And so if not breaking any sexual harassment law, if you go and work there and have guys harass you. Now, if somebody physically does something to you, well, then that could be illegal, right? So in other words, the employer would have that basic standard in place, just like the guys going to work there who are real crude and tell all kinds of dirty jokes. They don't want someone knifing them in the back and saying, hey, we're all tough guys here. That's just all good in sport. No, somebody knifes you in the back, you want to be able to sue the guy. Okay, so whereas other places, like an accounting firm that wants to have secretaries working there and other people and have it be a friendly environment, they want to have, you know, young women who are trained as accountants or whatever come work there, they might have a zero tolerance policy. So you come work here and we get a complaint from somebody that you're being crude in the workplace, you're out of here. You know, we have safeguards to make sure it's a valid complaint, but if we're pretty sure you did it, part of your employment contract says you can't do this. And there might even be standards in place saying, you know, what the penalty is and so forth, right? So there's all sorts of different oases of various rules and things regulating human conduct that would emerge. And I think it's correct to describe that whole society as being under what we could call the rule of law. Because if you push through, what do you mean by that? It doesn't mean that every single person has the exact same set of rules applied to him or her. Because if that's what you meant, then the rule of law never existed on Earth ever, and you wouldn't want it to. That wouldn't be an ideal. That would be a nightmare if every single person had the exact same set of legal rules pertaining to them. And now if you step back and you generalize it enough and you say, well, no. I mean, at a certain level of abstraction, that's the common framework that I want to apply to everybody in my society. Well, then, okay, if that's the kind of rule of law you're talking about that would be desirable, then I agree that's a good thing to have. And I claim empirically that's what would happen in an anarcho-capitalist society, or rather something closer to that would apply as opposed to in a statist society. Because, and the reason for that, let me just justify that claim, the reason for that, what I'm saying, the kind of rule of law you'd actually want would be more likely to be produced by a free legal system, is that what people really care about, stuff like serious bodily aggression and actual theft of physical property, where, you know, stuff that people don't care as much about, like stealing so-called intellectual property. Certainly a lot of the things that right now the government puts people in prison for would not be high on the list of priorities of people in a genuine private property society. And so you might say, oh, right now a legal monopoly of force that the government exercises, say what you will, but they can ensure more of a homogeneity of the legal code applied to everybody uniformly. Okay, that might be true, but it's not the uniform legal code you'd want applied to everybody. So yeah, it's like, hey, anybody who criticizes the government ends up in jail. We apply that rule to everybody. It's the rule of law. Well, that's not what people, that's actually the antithesis of the rule of law in most people's minds. Whereas the government lets, you know, big bankers get away with ripping people off and so forth under a government system. So you could have on the books this legal framework, this homogeneous rule of law in a statist world, but in practice, the same rules would not get applied to people. The people with political pull would have favors done on their behalf. The judges would look the other way when crime bosses are moving all sorts of heroin, and they'd throw the book at you if you're a teenager and you're not part of the gang and you get caught and you haven't been paying off the judges and the cops and you get caught, well, then you're going to jail for 25 years. So even though the law applies to everybody equally, it actually in practice wouldn't be enforced that way. Whereas under a private legal setting like we're talking about in this class, the actual legal principles and frameworks might be very heterogeneous. You know, there could be certain communities, like the Amish over here have one set of laws that apply to them when they deal with each other, and if they have a dispute in their community, they go to an Amish judge, or a judge who at least knows their legal framework. Whereas if they have a dispute with an outsider, maybe they got to go to somebody else who's more neutral. So there could be all these things like that, but in terms of what would be the profitable, spontaneous order outcome, clearly you would say in this society, murder is illegal. Now, it would have different nuances from place to place and depending on which legal framework, but it would be a true statement to say murder is illegal in this society. Just like in the U.S. right now, murder is illegal, even though the legal codes differ from state to state. Okay, the role of precedent. So here, part of what the judges are providing is predictability. So if you are, remember, what is the basic framework here? It's when people have a dispute, they want to have some third-party judge come along and render an opinion. So if two Amish people have a dispute and they want it to be settled with the kind of legal framework that the Amish people endorse, they're going to go seek out a judge. They're going to agree, okay, we can't settle this among each other. Let's go submit to this judge or arbitrator, whatever they want to call him, and he knows the principle. So what are you going to do? Well, the way they're going to settle on somebody is if the person in the past has demonstrated consistency and an understanding of the type of law code that they think is legitimate. So necessarily, they're going to want to have some understanding of how the person's going to rule. So forget the Amish thing. Let's switch to something more conventional. The thing I've been talking about all lecture. Two homeowners, clearly each owns his own house, but one guy's blasting his stereo at 3 a.m., and for whatever reason, when they moved into this neighborhood, that wasn't part of the original contract. It was never spelled out, can you play your radio at 3 a.m., or the specific amount of decibels that you could set at your parties at was never spelled out quite clearly. And so the one guy brings a lawsuit against the other one, and so they're trying to figure out where to go. Well, if they go to some judge, and the judge who has been specializing in residential property disputes for 20 years, and they go and look at his rulings, and they say, oh yeah, this guy, he refers to the ACME standards, he refers to all these previous cases, he says, well, the principle that was enunciated the last time, so-and-so, 3 years ago, Jim Smith brought a case against John Jones, and Jim was saying that Jones was watering his plant so much that it was actually causing damage to his tree, because he had this special exotic tree on his property that was right near the borderline. And so in that case, what the judge ruled was blah, 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 and the community seemed to like that. That seemed like a fair ruling, and people can all see the merit and that sort of approach the judge applied there. So by precedent, by analogy, I'm going to take that principle and apply it here. And so judges are acting like this in the framework, so now you and the person you're having the dispute with can see, oh, this is how this guy rules. And so let's go ahead and submit our case to him, because I like what he said. Whereas if some judge is out there saying crazy stuff like, well, you know what I did? What I do whenever I have a thing is I go out and I get the Ouija board. And then I contact the spirits and I say, guide me and let me figure out what the ruling is here. Well, obviously no one's going to go to that guy. And so that's where this role of precedent comes in. The reason a successful judge, a judge who prospers in this industry of providing judicial rulings for pay, the way you would rise to the top of that industry and get a lot of clients is, among other things, they would have your opinions would need to be predictable. They would kind of have to know that, all right, we're having this one kind of dispute. The ruling is going to be of this form, and we're just not sure exactly where he's going to draw the line. So we're having a labor management dispute. The employee says, you owe me 3 months of pay because I was sick, but because I was sick because of, the chemicals in your plant. So I want you to pay me. And the employer says, hey, you can't prove that. Well, the judge, they don't know how the judge is going to rule. The judge is going to have to bring in doctors and testimony and blah, blah, blah. And the judge is either going to rule that, yes, the chemicals in the factory are what made this worker sick, so therefore you got to pay his medical bills and his lost wages. Or maybe he'll say you just got to pay his medical bills. Or maybe he'll say you got to pay that plus some compensation over and above. But the judge is not going to say, you, the employer, have to cut your arm off because you should have known better than to have these chemicals out. Because that would just be out of left field. There's no precedent in the law for that. Were you kidding me? So you see the point, that judges just making stuff up and not tying their rulings to this pre-existing body of law and trying to couch their rulings as an application of accumulated past rulings to say this is just one more example in this long line of precedent. There's nothing metaphysically stopping them from just being completely loose cannons and just firing off opinions, but they would probably go out of business. So that's how I see precedent evolving in this framework and why the market would select for judges who rely on precedent in their rulings. Okay, what about so-called outrageous rulings? Just real quickly, so here the issue would be, what if there's this case where, what I have in mind is where the law clearly says what the ruling is going to be. I mean, the judge comes along and says, geez, in this case, with the precedents and whatever, you know, it's crystal clear if I am at all going to apply the existing body of law to this particular dispute, I have to rule in favor of either the plaintiff or the defendant, and here's why, and the judge can explain. But what if it just offends everybody's sense of justice? So, you know, so what happens there? Well, a couple things. So first of all, private property owners can still respond to the person however they want. So if somebody clearly is a killer and does something, and then, but just for some quirk, and I can't think of a compelling example, but just for some reason, oh, geez, technically the way the law has evolved and whatever, in this specific crazy set of circumstances, the law can't touch this guy. We can't say he's guilty. Well, still, his employer can fire him, can say, well, I don't want him working here. And the insurance company that was vouching for him can say, well, we no longer vouch for this guy. He's off of our books. And, you know, if you want to still be part of our network, then you have to go to agree to live, you know, these restricted movement facilities and so forth. All right, so there's a lot of stuff that people can, within their own existing property rights, can respond to somebody that technically should be guilty and be a convicted criminal, but yet they're not. So just keep that in mind. There is this bit of flexibility in the legal system. And also, too, a lot of the things that we right now attribute to outrages of the legal system are due to the fact that it's the government being involved. Like, so for example, in the O.J. Simpson case, I read a book by Alan Dershowitz commenting on this, and what Dershowitz said is that the jury knew he was guilty, but they acquitted him because they thought that the police had framed a guilty man. Okay, so that, I'm personally not saying whether that's true or not. I didn't follow the O.J. Simpson case all that much. Okay, but this was what this was the claim by Alan Dershowitz, who many of you may not like. All right, so he's saying that it's a regrettable necessity in our current system that police will routinely lie. They will, like, the police pull somebody over or they break into somebody's house and they know the guy's a criminal in their mind. They think the guy's guilty of something, but they want to have a slam dunk case in court, so maybe they plant drugs up. So they think some guy's a drug dealer and they pull him over and technically in his trunk there's no drugs. But come on, we just know this guy's guilty, so they might plant some drugs in there and then tell the judge with a straight face in court, yeah, we pulled the guy over, we asked to look at his vehicle, he gave us permission, we opened a trunk, and there was a kilo of cocaine. So there you go. And I swear on the Bible that what I just said is true. And so Dershowitz is explaining that the police and the judges do this routinely because, you know, not necessarily that they're corrupt, but because in their minds they just think, well, there's these crazy legal rules, all these legal protections. But well, come on, we know these guys are criminals, and this is just a technicality. And this is what we have. These are the hoops we have to jump through to get them behind bars where they belong. That's the mentality that sometimes juries come along and see this, and occasionally will just protest and no, and acquit the guy. And so, again, what is really interesting is cases where the police will frame somebody who actually is guilty. Because at first, you might say, what would be the point of that? But, for example, in the O.J. Simpson case, and again, I'm not saying that I agree with this. I don't know. But what Dershowitz was saying is, in his mind, he evaluated the evidence and everything. He thought that Simpson did kill his ex-wife, and Dershowitz thought that the police planted evidence to make Simpson look guilty, and some of that evidence was planted by the police. So you could say, why would they do that? If he actually did it, why would they need to? Well, because it wasn't a slam-dunk case. Maybe the police were sure he was guilty, but they weren't sure with what they had that a jury would convict him beyond reasonable doubt. So they tipped the scales in favor of guilty by manufacturing evidence. And then the defense, Dershowitz claims, caught the police doing this and pointed it out. And so now the jury is like, whoa, we've caught the police lying to us. You know, these guys who are in here testifying now, the defense has raised legitimate objections to that, and now we're not sure that the state might be lying to it, so let this guy go. That's, and Dershowitz was saying that's kind of a bulwark of freedom and individual liberty in our system, where the state needs to know, the cops need to know, don't frame a guilty man even, certainly not an innocent man, because you may end up letting him go free. You will prejudice your own case if you do this kind of stuff, and that's the only way we as citizens can push back. That's what Dershowitz's point was. So again, notice all that kind of stuff gets totally minimized in the system we're talking about here. You don't need to worry about police framing people because there's competing police forces or whatever the analog of the police would be, investigative agencies, detective agencies. If one detective agency is consistently caught fabricating evidence at a crime scene, you know, some company specializes in collecting blood samples and doing DNA tests to see if the guy in custody, or the guy who's accused, maybe he's not in custody, if his blood type matches the blood that was found at the scene of the murder. And if some company gets caught tinkering with that in the lab and they, you know, say, oh yeah, we took this sample and this guy's blood and they match, and then it's determined from an internal memo or something or a whistleblower that no, they actually, in that big murder case, they lied. The blood types didn't match and they said that they did. Well, that company's out of business. Nobody's ever going to go to them again. They're going to go somewhere else, right? So in a freely competitive system, these kind of outrageous things are going to be vastly minimized compared to the present system. Okay, and then the last thing, and I'll catch your guys' questions in the, you know, I'll answer them in written form since we're over time. Last thing is the appeals process. So how does this work? Well, let me give you the basic story is that somebody has a dispute and he takes it to a certain reputable, or so two neighbors have a dispute, they take it to a reputable judge or arbitrator. And they agree beforehand, we're going to be bound by his opinion, but they can have clauses saying, even beforehand, that yes, we agree to be bound by the decision, but we might have the right of appeal. So all this stuff, the right of appeal and so forth, can be specified in advance. So maybe if a better example would be like two giant corporations that have a major lawsuit, and there's billions of dollars at stake. They might want to specify, okay, we're going to take it to a first person, get one ruling, and then we're going to have the ability, you know, the loser, if he wants to, if he thinks that, no, I really think that our case, that was a misapplication of the law, I really think we should get a second opinion. That can all be specified beforehand in their original agreement. They can say, we're going to go to this arbitrator, and they might just, in terms of limiting the process, because again, they don't want to be tied up in court forever, they might just arbitrarily say, we'll go to up to five judges. And that's the most we can do, though. And then after that time, if three or more of the judges have ruled in favor of one of us, then that's where it goes. So clearly, you know, if two judges in a row, it's a slam dunk and rule in favor of the plaintiff, the defendant might realize, well, there's no point in paying the legal fees to go through this again because I'm not going to get three in a row. You know, if I'm down 2-0 in the series, I'm not going to come back and pull out a win. Fine, I guess the law isn't on my side. I thought it was. All right, so that's how it would work if it's specified in advance. Even just, but you say, okay, well, suppose you're dealing with somebody, like somebody breaks into my house and steals my TV. So it's not like I have a pre-existing contract with the guy regulating, okay, if we ever have a dispute, how are we going to settle it, blah, blah, blah. I still can go up to him, remember this mechanism I talked about, and say to the community, I think this punk from down the street stole my TV. I accuse him. I'm bringing, you know, hey, punk kid, I'll take it to any judge specializing in criminal law, you know, home invasion, burglary, some judge specializing in that body of law. You pick the judge. I'll be... And then we can have, you know, it can just be standard procedure, a customary in our society that you get to appeal a certain number of times. Or you can have the ruling, and then the kid thinks he was treated unfairly. Or even better, suppose new evidence comes to light. right? So the kid, we go to the first judge. The kid agrees because the kid wants to clear his name. He doesn't want the community thinking he's a TV thief. And the first judge rules against him. He says, no, you know, Murphy's got you on surveillance tape. It's true. I can't actually see your face, but it's your build, and you don't have an alibi. And all of a sudden, the neighbors said, you got a brand new TV the very day that Murphy said he was robbed. And maybe in reality, the kid's innocent. You know, maybe it's his fluke thing where some guy who looks just like him broke into my house, and that kid actually got a present from his buddy from out of town who came by and gave him a new TV on that same day. It's just this freak set of coincidence, but that buddy can't be located now. He can't give him the alibi. Oh, man. And so the judge ruled against him, but the kid knows he's in it. And then over time, 3 months later, the kid actually gets in touch with his buddy who was out in Africa, and now he came back. And so the kid goes to a new judge and says, hey, there's new evidence. My alibi's in town now. He can vouch for the story I told. And then, you know, that new judge might say, oh, well, this is interesting. Maybe, so the question would be, if we held the trial again today with this new evidence, might the ruling be different? And if that's the case, you might go through the trouble of that, and then there could be an overturning of the prior ruling. All right, so that's the mechanism. Whereas if all the judges in the community say, nah, kid, this is your cousin, and this guy's a known liar, and I'm not going to overturn that previous judge's ruling, then, you know, they wouldn't. And remember, what the judges want is predictability. That's part of their business. So as a judge, if you're going to make a ruling, you want to make sure it's fairly airtight. You don't want your competitor to come along and say, that's not what the law said in this case. So appeals would happen, but they would be fairly rare. Because once we got into an equilibrium where there's judges who have been in the industry for a while, the reason they're so reputable and on top is because their rulings stand the test of time. No one's going to want to go to a judge who half of his rulings get overturned within 2 months. Because even if he rules in your favor, that's not reliable, because you know it's probably going to get reversed on appeal. Okay, so that's the way these competitive pressures would interact with each other. All right, we're over time. Let me stop there. Thanks, guys, for tuning in, and I will answer your questions in the Moodle framework.